My mother and father were former sharecroppers from Manning, South Carolina. They came to Baltimore right after they got married in the 1940s. They had less than, I think mom had like a third grade education. Dad had a fourth grade education, and they had been sharecroppers. In other words, they could actually, my father could trace his sharecropping efforts to slavery, same land. And so they were made to pick the strawberries and tobacco and plow the fields. And so they took them out of school, and they were not allowed to go to school. And even if they could go to school, as they tell it, the school was like 3-4 miles away. And a lot of times they had to travel through woods and whatever. And so they came to Baltimore. And their vision was to educate all of their children. It wasn't about just getting a better pay. It was about opportunity. We weren't even born yet, but they had a vision for us. And I'm telling you this for a reason, because it all hooks together. So mother was a domestic. Daddy was a laborer. And they would be gone all day in the summertime, and we would go to the pool. Now, I lived in South Baltimore, 126 West Cross Street. This house is still there. And this is near Hamburg Street Bridge. And anybody who knows anything about South Baltimore knows that if you were going in that main front gate of Raven Stadium, there's a bridge right there, the main, and that's Hamburg Street Bridge. When you walk easterly over that bridge, you were where I lived. It looked a lot different then. And on that side of the bridge, there's still African Americans, many of whom, by the way, lived there when I lived there 55 years ago. And if you notice, there's a small black area, and then you cross Light Street, and you move into, you see a lot of white people. And I wasn't trying to be funny, but we had a pool. We had a little playground at the end of that bridge. As soon as you get over the bridge, there was a little playground, and literally it had a pool about the size of this stage. It was a wading pool. It was about 2 feet deep. And the pool was so small, you got to keep in mind, back then families had on the average of 5, 6, 7 kids. And the pool was so small that we literally had to wait turns to get in the pool. And it was supposed to be cooled off in the waiting pool, but by the time, you keep in mind what I'm saying, cement at the bottom, right? maybe 100, 150 kids in this little space at one time. And if you didn't make the first round, you literally got into some pretty hot water. I mean, it was hot. But that was our world. That was our world. And then something happened. A fellow named Jim Smith, who was our recreation leader, and no one will ever tell me that parents and adults cannot have phenomenal impact on children. A fellow named Jim Smith, who's still living, by the way, and who helped me in my first campaign when I ran for Congress 15 years ago. Jim Smith said, you know what? I'm tired of this. This African-American man who had been in the military, had reached the rank of captain, was now a recreation leader. He said, I'm tired of this. And he told us little kids, I must have been 9 years old, this is around 1960. He said, there's a big pool about 10 or 15 blocks away, and I want you all to go into that pool. So he gathered us together, and we marched over to the pool. And we looked, and we couldn't believe it. There was an Olympic-sized pool. And imagine, see, a lot of people don't know what race does to the psyche of people, particularly kids. Here you are, a little kid, and you're standing in line waiting for an hour or two to get in a pool with 2 feet of water. And then you go a few blocks away and see people, maybe 20 or 25, jumping into an Olympic-sized pool. You begin to ask yourself, what is this? Did I miss something? What's wrong with me? And then you begin to see something else. See, you got to understand, we were analyzing this from the standpoint of a child. A child deals with things from an emotional standpoint. Adults, intellectual. And so we're sitting there saying, wait a minute. And then we look at all the people in our pool, and it was segregated. We look at the people at the Riverside pool, and it was segregated. And so Mr. Smith, he just wanted us to see what we were aiming at. And then we went back. He talked to our parents, and the next thing you know, every day we would march to the pool for several days. And I'll never forget, I have a scar on my face right now where adults, I can still see their faces. And you know what the interesting thing is? I can feel the same feelings right now. That was 50 years ago. I can feel the same stuff. And one of them hit me with a milk bottle. I'll never forget it. Cursing at us, calling us everything but a child of God. And then there came a woman named Juanita Jackson Mitchell from the NAACP. I didn't even know what the NAACP was. But she said, we're going to help you. And she came with a whole group of people, and we marched some more. And finally, there came a day when we integrated the pool. But the damage was done. See, a lot of people think once you get past something like that and you say, oh, I've got a victory. We can now go in the pool. We can now go in the pool. I'm excited. We can go in the pool. Damage is done. Damage is done because you begin to realize. See, as long as you're in that little world, in your little world where you don't know there's something better, it's your little world. But when you go out and you see a world blocks away, it's a whole nother thing. And so what lessons came out of this for me? First of all, it has made me color everything black and white. If somebody white would do something to me, I automatically thought it was racist. And a lot of folks won't tell you this from my generation, but it's true. They won't tell you that. And you have to literally fight in your own mind to say that it's not. It's sort of like the gentleman was speaking a moment ago about these certain presumptions that come along and that are part of your psyche. There's another thing that happens that makes you wonder. There used to be a song entitled, What Becomes of the Brokenhearted? I think about that song every day of my life because I realize that there are so many children who went through similar experiences that I went through that were negatively affected, and they did not have perhaps the parents to talk to, or maybe the parents didn't understand it, or maybe they didn't have the religious background that I was blessed to have. And I'm not saying I'm anything special, don't get me wrong. But the fact is that a parent trying to explain to a child why it is that he gets, for example, the books that have been used and torn apart from the white kids, trying to explain that is hard because you as a little kid don't understand it. It makes no sense. And I remember saying to mommy, but ma, hey ma, you know, I look, we just different colors. I said, they white and I'm brown. And it was so hard for her to explain it. But what becomes of the brokenhearted? What becomes of them so often is they go through life, first of all, with low expectations. They go through life believing that there is a ceiling that has been placed on up here. And I've often said that the hardest thing, the toughest ceiling to break is the ceiling that you put in your own mind. so many of them fall by the wayside. Because, yeah, they dreamed. They dreamed to be the lawyer or the doctor or whatever. And then they saw, while they may have seen the victory at Riverside, they also felt the pain of getting there. And because they were children, they did not fully understand it. And so, you know, we do have to get past this race thing. People ask me all the time, so why do you live in the young lady who came up here, our guest lady, the one that talked about the ghetto, ran into the black neighborhood. That's my neighborhood. No, seriously, that's where I live. And the thing that drew me back there, and I wasn't insulted or anything, but the thing that drew me, I could live in so many places. But the thing that drew me back there is because I wanted to have an impact on kids. I wanted to make them realize that they were somebody and that they could have great things and they could be in the White House, that they could be president, that they could be a congressman. And I don't consider it it's something special, but when you have seen that kind of rejection, you just want to say, I mean, and even now, a lot of people don't know it. I spent my first 5 or 6 years in school in special ed. They told me I was in special ed because I talked too much. That's a true story. And I'll never forget when we would go to the white school. By the way, the white school was on the other side of the bridge. We only had 9 rooms in our school. And I'm almost finished now, but we only had 9 rooms. And when we would go across the track, we would go to the school, and it blew my mind. I couldn't believe it. First of all, we had in my school no cafeteria. We had no auditorium. We had no gymnasium. When you went over to, I'm talking about, keep in mind, talking about Hamburg Street Bridge. When you walked across the bridge, there was a school right there. As soon as you got to Pastor Rue, there's a parking lot now. But what they had was this big, the thing that I remember the most that stuck out in my mind is when you went in the halls, they had the bulletin boards that kind of were indented with lights. I couldn't believe it. No, seriously. We went into the auditorium, and it looked just like, very nice like this. I couldn't believe it. Cafeteria, food everywhere. Couldn't believe it. And again, you know, again, that was one of those moments. This is, hey, Elijah, what's going on here? Ladies and gentlemen, as one of the older folks up here, some kind of way we have to teach our children to put color to the side. And I think they're doing it. I think they're doing it. Let me just tell you and tell you why I think they're doing it. I'll never forget. And this is it. When I was running around the country campaigning for President Obama, I can tell you, I was amazed. I had gone over the country and I'd see these people, and I see auditoriums, 20,000 people, and so finally we got to College Park. And when we got to College Park, there was about 20,000 in the auditorium. There were about 10,000 standing outside. There were about 8,000 in the lacrosse field. And a whole lot of them had been there since around 12 o'clock the night before. So I had an opportunity to talk with the president of student government and some other students after the rally was over. I said, why'd y'all come out for this black man? Because most of them were white. They said, Congressman, you're confused. They said, we did not come out for a black man. We came out for somebody we believed in. And it hit me. It hit me that I was still operating on my experiences and what I had seen. Keep in mind that when Obama first ran, people, you know, it was black people who were not supporting him. You know why? Not because they did not like him, not because they did not believe in him, but their experiences had told them that white folk would never vote in those kind of numbers for a black man. And if you ask anybody, they'll tell you that. So when he won Iowa, and when he came second in New Hampshire, all hell broke loose. Because the black folks started saying, he can win. But what I'm saying to you, and so people ask the question, why is it that black people are so excited? And I close with this. So this is not a political speech, but they ask the question, why are they so excited? It's because so many of our experiences have been colored in black and white. So many things that aren't even races, because of experiences, you go with a presumption that is racist. And in many instances, it's not. And so I'm just, you know, I just hope when I tell my kids, I say, you know, when you have a feeling, when you get a feeling, women, y'all know what I'm talking about. You get this feeling. Men don't know what feelings are, but I say, when you get a feeling, women say, you know how I feel. And the man said, what feel? What does that mean? But I just got this feeling just now. And I was telling my daughter said, I have my 28-year-old, she says, what do you feel real good about, Dad? And I said, I love my kids. I love you guys. You're just wonderful. I love you. I said, I can go to my grave now. She said, why do you say that? I said, I've lived a good life. I said, I can go to my grave because we have elected an African-American man to the presidency of the United States. I said, and now, you know, maybe I don't have to try to be the example or the role model. Or what. They got somebody who's made it to the top. But that's how a lot of people feel. And so all the feelings that I talked about with Riverside, those negative feelings, maybe, and you try to figure out, what is it that I can do to make my children realize that they must have high expectations and that not everything is colored with race and that there are a lot of very good people of all colors who really care and want people, every single child, to grow up being all that God meant for them to be. How can I make them realize it? Barack Obama. Thank you very much.